Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 60, special COVID-19 edition number 8, but who's counting? It's Friday, May 1st. I'm coming to you from the Donald Trump Memorial Studios, which still looks eerily like my den. As I shelter in place, I hope you are all staying safe, protecting yourself and others. Well, Donald Trump is holding steady at completely delusional when this week he claimed the coronavirus will be eradicated in the U.S. before any vaccine is developed. Enter Donald J. Trump, also known as the Don, liar in chief. King of narcissism, bankrupt businessman, faux billionaire, television huckster, and the plutocrat preferred by millions, who conned himself into the biggest job of all, the tweeter-in-chief of the not-so-United States of America. He is our guide to a surreal realm that you won't find on any map, a world of his own creation, where notions like science and facts no longer have any meaning. Where man's darkest instincts are given license, and where things like human decency and compassion are relics of a bygone era. Case in point, Mr. Donald Trump, a man with one foot in his mouth and the other in the Twilight Zone. Well, today is May 1st, International Workers Day, but Donald Trump had something different in mind this week.
Mayday! 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 Mayday!
Instead of celebrating workers and securing workers' rights and safety, the Don invoked the Emergency Defense Production Act to keep meat processing plants open. Why? Not to assure worker safety, rather to limit the liability of meat processing companies when they inevitably harm their workers through unsafe working conditions. Mr. Trump was concerned that the meatpacking CEOs were protecting their workers too much. Well, meatpacking plants and prisons are the biggest hotspots for COVID-19 outbreaks. Unfortunately, meat processing plants and prisons are much too similar in that they both have crowded conditions and are occupied by people that many people don't really care about that much. That is prisoners, no surprise there, as well as immigrants and low-wage workers. This, Trump's latest act, is perhaps the best illustration that Trump and his America care far more about corporations than people. Well, fear not, my friends. America is still full of baloney, and Trump is doing everything he can to keep it that way. In completely unrelated news, pickle loaf is a triple threat, killing those who make it, those who eat it, and the coronavirus, since, well, nothing can actually live on pickle loaf. However, coronavirus does thrive on ailing democracies.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you, your friends and loved ones, your city, state, your entire nation, suffer from an unprecedented crisis? Then your body politic may be infected with TLTL 2020 virus, also known as the TL20 squared virus. This too little too late 2020 virus has many vague and contradicting symptoms, but it is known to be exacerbated by election years. Do you suffer from exponential anxiety, worldwide depression, and recurring hallucinations of unimpeachable leadership? Don't worry, as the 2020 campaign season heats up, this will all go away. We don't call it a novelty virus for nothing. Hey people, don't look down. Things are looking up. Body bag futures are looking fantastic. This promises to be the best pandemic ever. Incredible things will happen as you save the world by doing nothing but watching TV. But remember, only get your Nothing Burgers from the drive-thru window. Please note, Nothing Burgers will now be referred to as Patriot Burgers. Doing too little has never been easier. Hey, what's the worst? That could happen. This message is brought to you by Cassandra Reproductions, seer of unbelievable futures, and maker of Pickled Posterity, coming too little, too late, to a shuttered store near you. You may now return to your regular programming.
Well, it may be too late to escape the prison of American so-called democracy, but for those incarcerated behind prison and jail walls, not just sheltering at home, this epidemic is raging. And it doesn't look like we are prepared to do much about it. This from the Columbus Dispatch. Coronavirus, 1 in 4 cases tied to state prisons. No plan for comprehensive testing. 1 in 4 of those confirmed coronavirus cases in Ohio are linked to Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction inmates and staff. Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections Director Annette Chambers-Smith appeared for the first time at one of Governor Mike DeWine's daily briefings, said there are no plans for comprehensive coronavirus testing across all 28 prisons. DeWine and Chambers-Smith both acknowledge that once the virus gets inside a prison, it is difficult to stop its spread, especially in lockups where inmates live in dormitories instead of cells. The Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections employs 12,272, including some 2,000 medical workers, and incarcerates 47,820 people in 28 prisons. Because of the close quarters of inmates and the huge workforce that comes and goes daily, COVID-19 outbreaks in prisons have the potential to spread quickly and then move beyond the walls. Comprehensive testing of staff and inmates has been conducted at 3 facilities, Franklin Medical Center, Pickaway Correctional Institution, and Marion Correctional. Cases have been confirmed in 24 of 28 facilities. It's already here, my friends. Testing will be done on inmates who show symptoms or are slated to be released and staff that wants it, Chambers-Smith said. So far, 5,676 inmates have been tested, and there has been 3,890 positives. I'm going to repeat that. Out of the 5,678 inmates that have been tested, 3,890 of them have been positive. Yikes. Sally Meckling, spokeswoman for the employee union that represents Department of Rehabilitation and Correction workers, said the state needs to expand testing to other prisons with confirmed cases and send more personal protective equipment for corrections officers. We want testing everywhere. We want to know how safe our people are. We see an uptick at Belmont Correctional Institution right now. Let's test everyone, she said. I hope she means the inmates too. Ohio Civil Services Employee Association President Chris Mabe said, "We know lack of testing and inadequate PPE is a bigger problem nationally, but it has local consequences every single day for frontline workers in our prisons. Our corrections employees are wearing homemade masks or reusing masks over and over. It is not safe and is putting lives at risk. Visits in the prisons have been halted since early March. Meals have been cut to 2 a day. Recreation options have been more limited, and staff submit to daily health screenings. Prisoners are grouped by housing units to limit intermingling." Guys are getting upset and they're getting anxious, Mansfield correctional inmate David Copeland said. Inmates across Ohio are housed in cells or open dormitory rooms, depending on the prison. Even with cell blocks, inmates are mingling, he said. When they let us out in the day room, we're not in a social distance situation. They're playing cards, they touch the ice machine, they touch everything. We are in a congregate setting, much like a nursing home, and that's why this is spreading like wildfire. David Singleton, director of the Ohio Justice and Policy Center in Cincinnati, said Chambers-Smith has been a national leader in taking steps to mitigate the virus, but we need mechanisms to allow for more safe and responsible release of people who are low risk of recidivism and high risk of complications from the deadly virus, he said. On the home front in Lucas County, when the Toledo mayor and the Toledo Lucas County Health Commissioner were asked about what's happening in jails and prisons, the sad answer is not much more than monitoring the situation. Well, unfortunately, sometimes public health turns out to be a spectator sport. Unless, of course, you're a member of the public, then you are an essential participant in this blood sport we call pandemics. I'm thinking that it would be better to have prison breaks than prison outbreaks. I'm going to ask for what I want. Release more prisoners. The sad fact is, this virus thrives on institutionalized populations that cannot protect themselves. And in the end, we are all in this together. Let's protect all of those who can't protect themselves.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's take a look at our local situation here in Toledo and Lucas County. Lucas County had a spate of COVID-19 deaths this last week, bringing our death rate to triple the state rate and 50% higher than the national rate. We have finally taken our traditional place as worse off than Ohio and the nation as a whole when it comes to public health. Wow, who could have seen that coming? Testing is increasing in Lucas County, adding a new focus this week on long-term care facilities, aka nursing homes. This is good news. Although the confounding part of increasing testing is that there are so many untested, unreported infections that increasing new case rates may be a better reflection of testing rates rather than underlying infections. We know that the testing rate in Ohio was ranked 45th out of 50 states. Since testing in Ohio and Lucas County has been driven overwhelmingly by those with symptoms, and even more so by hospitalizations, which are going to happen pretty much if you were testing well or not, we can look at hospitalization rates relative to identified infection rates. In Ohio, the proportion of identified cases which are hospitalized is less than 20%. For Lucas County, it is 32%. This likely means that we are testing at a rate relative to overall infections that is much lower than Ohio as a whole. The U.S. has a long way to go to reach adequate levels of testing. Ohio has an even longer way to go relative to the U.S. and Lucas County has an even longer way to go to reach adequate levels of testing than both Ohio and the U.S. We know that in Lucas County, we are leading the state in deaths coming from nursing homes, a very high-risk population. But what about that all that social distancing we are practicing? First, we know that with gradual efforts to roll out business reopenings, that social distancing restrictions can be expected to loosen rather than tighten. We can also probably safely assume that social distancing will lessen as quarantine fatigue sets in and good weather sets in. So, based on cell phone data, the U.S. social distancing grade has moved from a D+ to a D- in the last week, and down from a C- a couple weeks ago. This change is being driven by increases in encounter density and a slow but steady rise in non-essential visits. Ohio has also moved down in the last week from a D- to an F, but did hold the same crappy ranking of 45th out of 50 states for effectiveness of social distancing. Lucas County dropped from a D to an F in the last week. Lucas County has moved way down relative to other Ohio counties since last week, moving from the middle of the pack, ranking 43rd out of 88 counties, down to 66th out of 88 counties. Among metropolitan counties, we are still ranked 7th out of 8 metropolitan counties. Amidst all of this, the Toledo-Lucas County Health Department reopened this week.
Mayday! 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 Mayday!
Of course, they originally closed due to 4 COVID-19 infections. Always leading the way. Always leading the way. Okay, let's get back to testing for a bit more. The feds released their so-called national plan for testing, which is most simply put, not a national plan. Once again, the feds are pushing the problem onto states and local governments. In my dreams, I was hoping for some kind of Manhattan Project or at least a moonshot. Well, it looks like we got less of a moonshot and more of a mooning of America. The key sentence in this national non-plan is this, okay? Wait for it. Quote, anyone who has came into contact with an individual who has tested positive should be screened for symptoms, and those who are symptomatic should be tested, end of quote. You sort of have to read between the lines. That is because it's not there. There is no plan to test asymptomatic persons, except for occasional surveys to monitor some populations some of the time. My diagnosis? This plan is literally sick. With no widespread plan to test asymptomatic persons, we are likely dooming ourselves to be perpetually chasing the ever-moving, largely invisible front lines of this pandemic. I can't help but get this picture in my head of a dog chasing its tail. It's never going to happen, but it looks like it could be a close race. Just keep staring at those daily testing numbers and new cases. It's mesmerizing. A car crash that's hard to look away from, if you don't mind colliding a couple of metaphors. And the clincher is, even if we caught the elusive tail, we wouldn't know what to do with it. And just a reminder, folks, testing itself does not prevent infections. Testing only documents infections. The real value of testing in stopping this pandemic is its value in conjunction with quick contact tracing. This means quickly identifying potential exposures and testing asymptomatic persons who may have been exposed. If your overall measure of success is being able to test any symptomatic person who wants a test, then we have already lost. If we don't aggressively target those who need to be isolated early in their infection, then we'll be stuck with this grossly inefficient society-wide quarantine, which is unsustainable at so many levels. Okay, here's an article that gets at this from the New York Times. Most Americans who carry the coronavirus don't know it. Almost the only people who are being tested for the coronavirus are those who have symptoms of COVID-19, an approach endorsed by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which provides guidance for states, that has probably revealed just a fraction of the people infected, putting thousands of Americans in danger, because most of those who carry the virus do not know it. What's needed is widespread testing of people with no known symptoms. A small set of blood tests for antibodies indicated that as many as 2.7 million New Yorkers may have been infected without realizing it, Governor Andrew Cuomo said on Thursday. That's in line with other findings. A recent study showed up to one-third of residents in Chelsea, a hotspot in Massachusetts, may have been infected, and only half of them could recall having a single symptom over the past 4 weeks. Another small study of pregnant women in New York City found that 15% tested positive for the virus, and 80% of them had no symptoms. Of the 840 cases on the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt, 60% were asymptomatic. So COVID-19 seems much more prevalent than our meager amount of testing has indicated, and millions of infected people may be innocently spreading the disease. We need to aggressively search for asymptomatic carriers, particularly among people who have frequent contact with the public and among vulnerable populations. This includes those who are infectious but will never develop symptoms and those who will develop them days after the test. Those in high-risk asymptomatic groups who must be urgently targeted include health workers, especially those in long-term care facilities, the homeless and those working in shelters, grocery store employees and delivery drivers, taxi drivers, emergency workers, employees in high-density workplaces like delivery warehouses and meat processing plants, and anyone who has had close contact with a known COVID-19 patient. These high-risk groups need to be tested as often as every 5 days, given that we know about the time it takes to develop symptoms after becoming infected, and those found to be infected should self-isolate immediately while their contact should be quarantined for 14 days. Testing will need to be expanded at least fivefold and made as accessible and convenient as possible, without the need for a doctor's referral and free of charge. Right now, about 200,000 people a day are being tested for the virus across the country. We need this to grow to around 1 million tests or more daily. Testing will be sufficient when fewer than 5% of the tests come up positive. In New York, 38% of those tested were found to be infected as of Wednesday. The number of new tests is also far too low. Louisiana, another hotspot, reported only 481 new COVID tests last Thursday in the entire state. To do this, states must expand mobile testing programs so workers like those in grocery stores and high-density workplaces can be tested repeatedly and on-site. They should also set up neighborhood testing sites to encourage everyone else to get tested without hassle. Scaling up testing will require a surge in strategic planning and supply chain management. The Food and Drug Administration recently approved new polyester-based swabs that can be swiftly manufactured domestically and don't have to be inserted as far up the nose. It also approved the use of sterile saline solution for transporting samples for testing if the medium that is normally used is unavailable. Newly approved testing platforms can deliver results in 15 minutes. These recent advances should ease supply chain bottlenecks and increase the availability of tests, but states will still need to build a vast testing infrastructure using community health centers, pharmacies, and private providers. The results of this hugely expanded testing will need to be digitally coordinated so infected people can be connected to the larger system of counseling, contact tracing, and supportive services. Massachusetts has started an ambitious collaboration between the Department of Public Health, the Commonwealth Health Insurance Connector Authority, and Boston-based partner in health to contact trace all infected cases. Expanded testing would let states more aggressively suppress the disease. Those with active infection could get support for self-isolation and contact tracing to identify others at risk who can be quarantined. To help those who cannot isolate safely, we need a chain of care adapted to American conditions that includes safe places for self-isolation, supported by tens of thousands of community workers who can perform testing and contact tracing and make it easier for people to quarantine. Already, some states have converted empty university dorm rooms and hotels for this purpose, but so far the effort has been patchwork. If we can't prevent the spread of COVID-19, the economy will not be able to reopen. Rapidly finding and isolating all infected patients, particularly focusing on the large pool of infected asymptomatic people and quarantining their close contacts before they've had a chance to infect others is the only way that the pandemic can be controlled until an effective COVID-19 vaccine is found. Well, I tried to set up an interview with our Toledo Lucas County Health Commissioner again, and I was blown off again after being told an interview time. After being stood up so many times, I'm beginning to feel like maybe our health commissioner may be the only person in Lucas County who is washing his hair more than his hands. But let's give it one more try.
Hello, thank you for calling your local health department. Press 1 for English, press 2 for press release ease, press 3 if you can't understand this message at all, press 4 for a directory of numbers that won't return your call, press 5 if your question can wait until the worldwide pandemic is over, Press 6 if your question is so urgent that you will be social distancing 6 feet underground soon. Press 7 if you really like the number 7. If none of these options are satisfying, please pound your hand under the keypad several times and hope for the best.
Okay, I did get an email saying he may have 10 minutes available on Monday, but he has to check with his handlers. Well, I won't be holding my breath. I still have yet to receive a single media release notice from the Toledo Lucas County Health Department. Still, I am working to track down whatever information I can find from other sources. I have learned that the Toledo Lucas County Health Department estimated that they will expand testing to 10,000 to 15,000 tests over the next month. The number of tests performed in Lucas County is not a regularly reported number. Knowing both the number of tests and the number of positive tests would allow us, the public, to see if the positivity percent is changing, which can give us better clues as to what the underlying rate of new infections might be. I'd like to see these numbers weekly. I haven't been able to find out what proportion of our testing is collected by healthcare workers and how much is, quote, self-swabbing, which may be somewhat less accurate, which I reported on in our last episode. Also, I haven't been able to find out how many tests are performed daily. The UT Medical Center has said that they could perform 160 tests per day, but they are reporting about a dozen tests per day. I just have to ask, what's up with that? I have a lot of questions about contact tracing locally. There are state and local efforts to ramp up contact tracing, but I can't get clear information on what this really means. The state is using a standard regarding the level of contact tracers needed that is meant for when we are not in an epidemic, which is only half the level recommended for when we are in an epidemic. I have not been able to get any handle on what's really been happening locally with contact tracing up to this point. I would also like a much better handle on what's happening in our local high-risk institutionalized populations, namely nursing homes and prisons. The expanded testing in nursing homes is being made available, as many as 6,000 tests potentially in over 67 long-term care facilities. Each facility can avail themselves of these tests, but they must want to and provide the staff to collect the samples. I must admit, I am a bit suspicious of nursing homes as businesses, seeing a potential conflict of interest in voluntarily identifying infectious diseases in their facilities. Just saying. Okay, a lot more to learn as we traverse through the pandemic. I'd like to read a couple of stories about high-tech and low-tech treatments for COVID-19, and then close with an editorial about where this pandemic may lead us in regards to social evolution or social devolution. Okay, first up from AP News, some doctors moving away from ventilators for virus patients. As health officials around the world push to get more ventilators to treat coronavirus patients, some doctors are moving away from using the breathing machines when they can. The reason? Some hospitals have reported unusually high death rates for coronavirus patients on ventilators, and some doctors worry that the machines could be harming certain patients. The evolving treatments highlight the fact that doctors are still learning the best way to manage a virus that emerged only months ago. They are relying on anecdotal, real-time data amid a crush of patients and shortages of basic supplies. Mechanical ventilators push oxygen into patients whose lungs are failing. Using the machines involves sedating a patient and sticking a tube into the throat. Deaths in such sick patients are common, no matter the reason they need the breathing help. Generally speaking, 40 to 50% of patients with severe respiratory distress die while on ventilators, experts say. But 80% or more of coronavirus patients placed on the machines in New York City have died, state and city officials say. Higher than normal death rates have been reported elsewhere in the U.S., says Dr. Albert Rizzo, the American Lung Association's chief medical officer. Similar figures have emerged from China and the United Kingdom. One UK report put the figure at 66%. A very small study in Wuhan, the Chinese city where the disease first emerged, said 86% died. The reason is not clear. It may have to do with what kind of shape the patients were in before they were infected, or it could be related to how sick they had become by the time they were put on the machine, some experts say. But some health professionals have wondered whether ventilators might actually make matters worse in certain patients, perhaps by igniting or worsening a harmful immune system reaction. That's speculation, but experts do say ventilators can be damaging to a patient over time, as high-pressure oxygen is forced into the teeny air sacs in a patient's lungs.
We know that mechanical ventilation is not benign, said Dr. Edie Fan, an expert on respiratory treatment at Toronto General Hospital. One of the most important findings in the last few decades is that medical ventilation can worsen lung injury, so we have to be careful how we use it. The dangers can be eased by limiting the amount of pressure and the size of breath delivered by the machine, Fan said. But some doctors say that trying to keep patients off ventilators as long as possible and turning to other techniques instead. Only a few weeks ago in New York City, coronavirus patients who came in quite sick were routinely placed on ventilators to keep them breathing, said Dr. Joseph Habushi, an emergency medicine doctor who works in Manhattan hospitals. But increasingly, physicians are trying other measures first. One is having patients lie on different positions, including on their stomachs, to allow different parts of the lung to aerate better. Another is giving patients more oxygen through nose tubes or other devices. Some doctors are experimenting with adding nitric oxide to the mix to help improve blood flow and oxygen to the least damaged parts of the lung. If we're able to make them better without intubating them, they are more likely to have a better outcome, we think, Habushi said. He said those decisions are separate from worries that there are not enough ventilators available, but that is a concern as well, Habushi added. There are widespread reports that coronavirus patients tend to be on ventilators much longer than other kinds of patients, said Dr. William Schaffner, an infectious disease expert at Vanderbilt University. Experts say that patients with bacterial pneumonia, for example, may be on a ventilator for no more than a day or two, but it's been common for coronavirus patients to have been on a ventilator 7 days, 10 days, 15 days, and then they're passing away, said New York Governor Andrew Cuomo when asked about ventilator death rate during a news briefing. New York State Health Commissioner Dr. Howard Zucker said that officials are looking into other possible therapies that can be given earlier, but added, that's all experimental. The ventilator is not therapeutic. It's a supportive measure while we wait for the patient's body to recover, said Dr. Roger Alvarez, a lung specialist with the University of Miami Health System in Florida, who is a leader in the effort to use nitric oxide to keep patients off ventilators for as long as possible. Okay, and that leads to the next story, which is the low-tech story. This from MSN.com. Proning is a promising treatment for coronavirus. Here's how it works. Some doctors on the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic are having success treating COVID-19 patients with a simple technique called proning. The term basically means putting a patient in the prone position, or flat on their belly with their chest and face down, rather than on their back. Jack Stewart, a pulmonologist with St. Joseph Hospital in Orange County, California, tells us. Proning requires little or no equipment, and the technique may prove to help patients who are critically ill avoid being put on ventilators for breathing assistance. Why does proning work? Flipping a patient on their stomach helps respiration because oxygenation, that is getting more oxygen into the blood, is easier in the prone position, says Dr. Stewart. It's a function of anatomy. As the human body has more lung tissue in the back of the body rather than the front, the coronavirus causes abnormal fluids and secretions to pool towards the back, where there's more lung tissue, and leads to greater interference with lung function. When a patient is in the prone position, gravity helps the secretions move downward, so more of the good lung is on top and therefore less affected. Harry Pellid, MD, a medical director in critical care at St. Jude Medical Center in Fullerton, California, tells us. Proning is also an effective treatment for a condition called acute respiratory distress syndrome, a life-threatening complication of coronavirus infection that manifests as shortness of breath and quickly progresses. A study published last month in JAMA Internal Medicine suggests that more than 40% of individuals in the study hospitalized for severe and critical COVID-19 developed the acute respiratory distress syndrome, and over 50% of those diagnosed died from the disease. The acute respiratory disease syndrome poses a risk to patients who have influenza, pneumonia, and pulmonary edema, that is fluid in the lungs from heart disease, as well. Proning has been used to treat the acute respiratory distress syndrome for a number of years, says Dr. Stewart. A 2013 study of French doctors published in the New England Journal of Medicine found that patients suffering from the acute respiratory distress syndrome had a lower risk of death if prone positioning was used in the hospital early on. Further research on how proning affects coronavirus patients is needed, but anecdotal evidence shows the effectiveness of the treatment since the global pandemic began. Okay, I want to close with this article from The Hill. What Jonas Salk would have said about COVID-19. There's a lot of speculation about a COVID-19 vaccine, From false memes that need debunking to physicians writing about renewed appreciation and longing for medical victories, like the development of the first effective polio vaccine. Hailed as medical miracle, the vaccine was announced 65 years ago on April 12, 1955. Dr. Jonas Salk, who led the team that developed it, was my father. Today, people often ask me what he would have thought or done about our current pandemic. My full answer may not be the one they expect. Yes, he certainly would have supported and participated in developing COVID-19 vaccines. He would have understood the urgency of seeking a vaccine and the grave responsibility to make it safe and effective. And he would have decried the tragic, sometimes preventable loss of life we are witnessing around the world. But here's a surprising part. Even though he's a historical figure identified with the triumph of medical science, he would have emphasized that there is more to eradicating disease than science alone. It also involves human-to-human social, political, and economic relationships. If he were here now, he would implore us to remember what made it possible to defeat polio, a national effort to develop and test the vaccine, and a worldwide effort to make vaccination available to everyone without profit. Millions donated money and volunteered their children for the largest field trial in public health history. International organizations and governments worked to ensure the entire world would get vaccinated. My father would insist on also making COVID-19 screening, treatment, and vaccination available to all of us, regardless of where we live or our social or economic standing. He would argue that doing so is not only morally right, but profoundly in our national and global interests. When it comes to infectious disease, health, unlike wealth, can't be hoarded by the few. As long as a virus is circulating in an immunized population, it's a threat to us all, and it's in all our interest to contain, prevent, and eradicate it. But he wouldn't have stopped there. He would have noted what implications the pandemic holds for our long-term future, and he would have connected to it the transformation we need at this juncture in human history if we are to survive. From the 1970s until his death in 1995, he thought deeply about this transformation and how we as a species might adapt successfully to population pressures and the approach of planetary limits. He examined the evidence and concluded that we must evolve societally, socially. In nature, evolutionary pressures and natural selection bear on competing individuals, but in the case of humans, we become evolutionarily successful through cooperation. My father believed that our future survival would depend on the values of collective human and planetary well-being becoming the drivers of our social, economic, and political lives. In his book, A New Reality, he showed that population growth is slowing and starting to plateau, a unique inflection point in human history that could also prompt a turn in our value system away from competition and independence and towards cooperation and interdependence. In an earlier book, The Survival of the Wisest, he argued that wisdom is the quality that will allow us to adapt and survive to conditions we have never encountered before. He would have recognized the COVID-19 pandemic not only as something to be feared and fought, but also as a moment to embrace wisdom. He would have seen this crisis as an opportunity to shift from individualism to interdependence. He would have told us that fighting the pandemic demands replacing the us-first, win-lose mindset with a we-together, win-win mindset, and he would have advised that, paradoxically, self-interest in this case is best served by generosity. He would have applauded cooperation and knowledge sharing among scientists and the altruism of medical workers and volunteers. He would have seconded New York's plea for mutual aid, help us now and we'll help you later, and he would argue we need to implement that mutuality at every level, from individual relationships to global society. He might point out the folly of placing material and economic value ahead of human life, as many of us are doing amid the pandemic. With an eyebrow arched, he might warn of the consequences of ignoring the workings of nature and continuing to pursue boundless growth, competition, and selfishness. He would let us know that if we persist in that way, we will be sowing the seeds of more suffering and, ultimately, our extinction. But my father was a scientist and an evidence-based thinker. Based on what he knew of evolution, he believed evolutionary pressures would nudge us in the right direction. He would have seen the pandemic as just such a nudge and would have appreciated the irony that a deadly virus, the same thing that prompted the advancement of medical science 65 years ago, might lead us now to advance social evolution toward a healthier, more cooperative, interdependent world where we can not only survive but thrive if we only listen. Okay, well, I think that's a good note to end the show on. If you'd like to listen to this show again, listen to any past show, or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. And a recent addition to accessing the show, you can go to the new Facebook page, which would be facebook.com/justforhealthWAKT, where the 4 is the number 4 rather than spelled out. That's facebook.com/justforhealthWAKT with the number 4. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.